I'm Dr. David Rabin, and this is Win the Day with James Whitaker.
You're listening to Win the Day with James Whitaker.
What we do in life echoes in eternity.
Broadcasting from Los Angeles, California, here's your host, James Whitaker.
Let's go!
Hey winners, welcome back to Win the Day. If this is your first time here, we sit down with some of the world's true change makers to give you all the tips, tools, and strategies to win the day every day. The quote for this episode comes from Hippocrates and says, "If you are not your own doctor, you are a fool." I'm super excited for this episode. Our guest is Dr. Dave Rabin, a neuroscientist, board-certified psychiatrist, health tech entrepreneur, and inventor. Dr. Dave has always been fascinated by consciousness and our inherent ability to heal ourselves from injury and illness. His research has focused on the clinical translation of non-invasive therapies for patients with treatment-resistant illnesses like PTSD and substance use disorders. In addition, his company, Apollo Neuroscience, has developed the first scientifically validated wearable tech that actively improves energy, focus, and relaxation. Dr. Dave and his work has been featured in the New York Times, Men's Health, Vogue, and the Tim Ferriss Show. And that's really an abridged version of Dave's bio. You can check out the show notes for a full version of all the incredible accomplishments this man has. In this episode, we're going to talk about the impact of chronic stress in the world we live in today, how plant and alternative medicines are reshaping the medical industry, what role you should play in your own health journey, and how to kickstart your own health, healing, and happiness. Before we begin, the right bit of inspiration can completely change the trajectory of someone's life. So there's a friend or loved one out there who needs to hear this episode or could use some help to win the day. Share it with them right now. All right, let's win the day with Dr. David Rabin. Dave, how are you, my friend? Thanks for coming on the show.
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me. We've been trying to do this for a long time.
We have. And I feel like you're just going from strength to strength in your career. So I know we're going to have an amazing conversation today.
Definitely.
To kick things off, was there a story of struggle or success from when you were younger that helped put you on the path you ultimately went down?
That's a good question. It's a mix, right? Our whole lives are kind of up and down. You know, pendulum swings in both ways, right? So you have struggle, you have success, and ideally they're balanced, right? And ideally struggles eventually over time, as we learn to grow and adapt them, turn into success and transform into growth, right? And I think for me, the thing that I think about that was most challenging for me growing up, well, was two things. The first of which, when I was very, very young, like many of us, I had very vivid dreams. So vivid and so real that at times I really struggled to identify whether they had happened, that the events had happened in real life. And, you know, I would be like, I don't know, between 4 and 7 years old, I'd be talking to my brother or talking to like a friend from school, and I would mention something that happened and they'd be like, "What are you talking about?" And I would instantly recall that this did not happen in this waking life. It happened when I was dreaming. And I was like, "Oh, that's so strange." And that I would confuse those things, right? Why would that happen? And I didn't really have anybody to talk to except my parents and about this. And so as I started to get older, started to have more like scary dreams, nightmares, as kids often do. And I would ask them, you know, what's going on? Like, what is happening when I'm asleep? And I think my parents told me what most parents tell their kids, which is, you know, to calm their fears. Don't worry about any of that stuff. It's not real, right? But then you keep having those dreams and you keep experiencing things that feel real as this when you're asleep. And so for me, I think, you know, that really started off this questioning, you know, in what we call like inquiry, self-inquiry concept, which was, what is real, right? If I'm feeling something that feels so real and indistinguishable from waking life when I'm asleep, but the adults say it's not real, right? Maybe we should be questioning what the adults are saying, right? And that caused me a lot of trouble over the years.
Sure. I was going to say, good to recognize that from an early age, but yes, would lead to a little bit of trouble along the way.
Yeah. And I think, you know, just growing up and growing up Jewish in America, I think we have a culture that I was talking to my wife about this yesterday. We have a culture that is very focused on questioning everything, right? Not to be a jerk, but just to understand why, like the reasons behind doing things. Even when we go like our religious experiences, like when we grow up and we go to synagogue or our equivalent of church or the holy, you know, our holy place on Saturdays, people in the audience are encouraged to argue with the rabbi, right? The teacher. how many other religions encourage that kind of engagement?
They're all
live,
about conformity, right?
Publicly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very interesting. And I didn't realize the impact of that until later, but ultimately I think that idea of questioning and that creating space where it's safe to ask hard questions actually was extremely beneficial to my development as a scientist, as a researcher, as a doctor, because as soon as I started to see things that didn't make sense in any way, I would just ask why and then start to dive in and dig a little bit, right? And or pull on the threads and see, like, where does this lead? Why is it that everybody thinks they know the answer to this question and they're giving the same answer, but that doesn't, like, they don't line up, right? There's something missing here. And I think that, again, was really helpful to me. But to answer your original question of what were the challenges, that was a huge challenge because most adults don't like being questioned about the way they've always done things, right? Whether you're a school teacher or you're a parent or a doctor or anybody, you know, when people, especially young people, kind of just come up to you and say, like, why are you doing it that way? Why are you doing it that way? We make jokes about this all the time, right? And I think that did actually, while it did dramatically help my growth of my own brain, personal development, it definitely caused challenges for me because people were like, who's this annoying kid always asking why about stuff all the time, right? But ultimately it worked out.
So how does a religion, this is not where I thought it was going to go to begin, which is great. I love
it. Let's freestyle.
Exactly. I love it when these things happen. When you're trying to tell an individual that you essentially need to not necessarily conform, but this is the way it is in terms of some religious tenets, some religious teachings, yet at the same time, you as an individual, you're trying to allow as much creative expression and critical thinking as possible. Mm-hmm. How do you sort of unite those things to keep everyone together?
Yeah, that's also a very good question. I mean, I think that's been a challenge of not just that, you know, it's not just a religious challenge. It's a challenge of society in general, right? Because for society to exist and to perpetuate over time, we have to have certain rules that everybody follows and that people, whether they understand those rules or not, they follow them because they're important for society to stick together, right? Like if somebody doesn't understand why it's not okay to hit somebody else, whether they're a child or an adult, they still shouldn't do it because it is disrespectful and could cause harm to somebody, right? And so that is something, there are certain situations like that where we need these fundamental basic rules to guide people so that their order is maintained and complete chaos and anarchy is prevented. At the same time, there is a certain, I think what Jewish religion and my friends who grew up in like more Ayurvedic traditions, Hindu yogic traditions, I noticed they also share this concept of there being this incredible amount of respect for young people and their inquisitiveness and their desire to know why. And I think that stood out to me as being so interesting because it teaches people how to critically think for themselves. And if you can think for yourself and you can effectively teach young people how to respect their own ability to make decisions, how to take information in, process it, figure out where things don't all fit together, where are the missing puzzle pieces, and then find those puzzle pieces from doing whatever they have to do and insert them, solve the puzzle, you're creating functional, independent, empowered human beings, right? People who are actually free to know how to learn, know how to intake information and process it properly, who are not going to be susceptible to groupthink. They're not going to be susceptible to conformity, right? They're not going to be susceptible to peer pressure. You're creating resilient, emotionally resilient human beings. And I think that is the part that we get so wrapped up in everybody just following the rules to maintain order that we forget about the critical importance of independent, empowered thinking, critical thinking, right? Because it can be annoying. So I think that's we need to remember that as much as it can be annoying to have to answer questions for people all the time, that's how we teach each other. That's how we empower each other to really be our best selves, is by helping people feel safe to ask the questions.
And I know you've done that in a religious sense. You've done that with the other doctors and physicians that you're around. You've done that in so many other areas of your life. Is it easy for you in the networks that you're in to be able to keep emotion? I mean, emotion like of other people. Does emotion come into it very often, or is it very well separated with the work that you do and the people you're around?
So, well, you know, in I think therapy is a really good example because I'm a psychiatrist, but I'm an unusual psychiatrist in that I do mostly talk therapy with people. I prescribe only when needed. Of course, I do have a general adult psychiatry practice, so you have to prescribe sometimes. But we try everything else first and least amount of side effect interventions first. And therapy is a really, really great teacher and as a way to understand what we have to do to be impartial and to understand our emotions as signals that are not good or bad. Right. So think about that for a moment. This is one of the most common misunderstandings of emotions is that emotions are instantly judged as soon as we feel them. If it's anger, sadness, et cetera, something that feels unpleasant, it's bad, right? Over something that we were told we were not supposed to feel as kids, right? It's not good. And if it's something that we were told we were supposed to feel as kids or it feels good, bring it on, right? Let's seek more of that. But that's us judging the emotion. The emotion is really just a signal. It's not good or bad. It's just a signal. It's just something coming in that's saying, hey, you should be paying attention to this because this makes you feel upset or angry or happy or joyful. You should pay attention to this. And there's a signal there. It's trying to teach us something. And in therapy, we learn this technique called observer mind, right? Which is basically just undivided listening without judgment, without expression of emotion, with just watching and listening and making sure that you or whoever it is that's on the other side of the conversation feels heard and seen, and that I am just taking it in without judging you, without putting any of me on what you're expressing. And then all of a sudden, we have a really meaningful interaction, right? Where we both are learning from each other because we both do that same thing for each other. And so I think a big part of it is how do we help people understand, which is a big, huge part of my career and something I really love. And one of my core passions is all of these things we're talking about, like what are emotions really, right? They're signals. They're not good or bad. Neuroscience has proven this. Psychology research over decades has proven this. We have really done a terrible job of translating that, which we have spent billions of dollars over the last 100 years proving to the general public for everybody to understand. So how do we start to take that information and then distill it down so that, you know, you don't have to go to medical school or graduate school or any school necessarily to understand how to interpret your emotions. You're a human being, right? We should be teaching this to kids at the very beginning, how to breathe, how to think, how to feel, right? And then that, how to self-soothe, right? How to take care of yourself. And all of a sudden the emotions become a tool that is like a superpower rather than something that starts to hold us back in all these different ways in our lives.
And you look at the ways that, you know, all the technology and information that we have access to, it is time for a massive disruption.
Absolutely.
into mental health. And a question I wanted to ask you, what are the, and obviously feel free to answer this as deeply or as surface level as you want, but what are some of the most pivotal moments from your own health journey?
Some of those pivotal moments. I mean, I think for me, a lot of it was the anxiety of, I mean, very, very realistically, very candidly, it was like the anxiety of growing up Jewish in America in a world where from the, and I hesitate to bring religion into it, but it's hard to separate, right? Because it's also a culture. And, you know, anybody who has not grown up Jewish doesn't necessarily know this, but when you grow up Jewish in America, you are taught about how the world has tried to kill you and all of your family and ancestors for thousands of years, which I think in a lot of ways is similar to growing up as a person of color in America, right? And studying slavery. It's you learn from a very young age that we have a really, or as an indigenous person, right? You learn that there's this really traumatic, aggressive history that involved one group of people trying to exterminate over and over again another group of people. And when you find yourself to be of one of the minority groups that was trying to be exterminated by the rest of the world, it creates a communal trauma, for lack of a better way of describing it. It's like it creates a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear of not belonging, a lot of fear of not being accepted by your community, a lot of fear of trust, right? Because when we learned about the Holocaust, one of the things that was emphasized so much to us, and this is to like us as like 8, 9, 10 year olds, was that our own people were hired to turn us in. And they did. Our neighbors who were our friends, they would, the people who came over for dinner, the people that we saw at social events where our kids went to school together, they weren't Jewish, but they were our neighbors. They were like, we were like in Germany, Jews were completely assimilated, more assimilated now than they are now in a lot of places. And their neighbors turned them in, right, to the Nazis for extermination, for complete annihilation. How can you trust anyone who's not of your people or even of your people when you learn these stories growing up, right? And so there's like a collective trauma that happens, and it creates like an enormous amount of fear and anxiety. And so for me, I think that was a huge part of it, and it impacted my parents, and it impacted the way that I saw my parents befriend other people in the community, how they always had their guard up around others. They never, like, we were a family that almost never let, like, we didn't have a lot of people over. My parents came from small families, always seemed like they wanted big families, but were always like afraid to let people too close. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
And that fear of abandonment is one of the most basic, like, fears that kids are born. Like, you know,
Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right?
Exactly.
It's like the number one.
Yeah. A kid, the way that one of my most vivid memories is the first time we dropped our daughter to preschool, and just, you know, it's like this wire fence. It's literally like a cage where they're just banging on this fence, screaming in a voice that you've never heard anything as horrifying as this, as the teacher reminds them that parents always come back. And I was, you know, as an instinct, your instinct is to jump that fence and take your kid with you. But you can't. It's not good for you, and it's not good for them. They need to be able to survive and adapt and develop skills of resilience and strength to be able to survive in this. In fact, my biggest fear that I have for my children is the day that I have to let them know, hopefully from me, not the world, that they realize that the world is a very big, dark, scary place. And that's something that I have been preparing for since day one, and I am terrified of it, but it's a very important responsibility that I'm very focused on and committed to.
Yeah, and it's a huge challenge, right? And there's so many, I don't know if there's a right way to educate our kids about that. Oftentimes we just wind up figuring it out on our own somehow.
Sure. And part of that, some of the things I'm doing, you know, that I'm focused on would be things like exposing them to the standards of living that other people have, being of contribution and service to people who have far less than what we have, making sure that gratitude is always such a big thing. I could think of nothing worse than having kids who are not grateful and appreciative for the immense amount of things that they have relative to what other people have. So as long as they're always focused on making the most of their potential, giving back and being grateful and being aware of what's going on in the world, I think it'd be a good start.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a few things more important as fundamental skills than gratitude that we should be teaching our kids from a young age. Because it's something that you can always take with you forever. And I think to come full circle on what you asked me earlier, which was, you know, one of the challenges that I faced in my, and how I sort of overcame it was gratitude, right? And having, growing up in a relatively small family, very small nuclear family, we didn't have a lot of relatives around. And my parents didn't have a lot of siblings, let alone almost no one who lived around us. And we didn't have a lot of close friends. And so for me, a lot of the way that I started to help myself overcome some of that collective trauma was prove to myself that I could trust people, right? Prove to myself that I could safely allow people into my life who were close friends that would not take advantage of me, that actually did have my best interests at heart. And so I basically set out on a mission to find those people. I was like, I don't believe that, well, I know, like, I believe my parents in that the world is a dangerous place. We were taught about it from a very young age. However, I also believe in the goodness, you know, and I think even if you go back and read the Old Testament, right, God threatened to destroy, in Genesis alone, God threatened to destroy the earth and all of humanity like multiple times. And there was always one human, at least one, who stood up and said, no, you have to save humans. Like, there's a sparkle of hope in there that we are amazing and that we are worth saving, right? And I think we see those sparkles all around us all the time, right? Through the practice of gratitude. Like, gratitude helps us to, like, walk down the street and see all the beauty rather than focusing on all the harshness and the things that make us afraid and uncomfortable. And then as we learn to practice gratitude, we actually train ourselves to self-soothe through discomfort, which is one of the single most important skills that we can ever develop as humans, but is best trained when you're a young child. You start to feel upset, uncomfortable. Don't run from it. Don't avoid it. Let's figure out how to sit with it and soothe ourselves and show that, as you said earlier, right? If you're your own doctor, kids can learn that. Kids can learn how to take care of themselves through breath and through soothing touch and through mindfulness techniques and all these different things that are way harder to learn as an adult. But gratitude's at the core.
Yeah, absolutely. From all your work in mental health, what insight or discovery has amazed you the most?
Oh, there's been so many, like really so many. And I still learn new things every day from both my patients that I work with, who have taught me so much, and also just life and being open to learning new things. I think I'll give you at least one and then we'll see where this goes. Right? So one of my most favorite discoveries that was never felt was passed down effectively to the general community, the general audience, as it were, who are not medically trained or scientifically trained, is kind of like thinking about the sayings that our moms and dads told us when we were kids, that we were like, whatever, that's not true, right? Like practice makes perfect, for instance. It in fact is true. Eric Kandel won the Nobel Prize in 2000 for discovering, who's also a Holocaust survivor, won the Nobel Prize in 2000 for discovering that in fact, practice does make perfect. There's no such thing as perfect. So we'll say practice makes mastery, right? And whether you are training things consciously or subconsciously, meaning you're like doing something on purpose because you want to get better at building muscle or you want to get better at practicing gratitude, so you practice more gratitude for yourself, all of a sudden you feel more grateful more of the time. You're training those neural networks to become stronger. And similarly, if you practice thinking about yourself as a crappy person who's unworthy of love, the more you think about yourself that way, the more we literally rewire and train our brains to default to think about ourselves that way. And that's really, really interesting, because that means that the things that we do and the way that we think, even about things like our emotions as good or bad, are all learned behavior, right? That means it's not personal. It's just what people taught us or what we learned growing up. It's learned behavior. And if it was learned, that means we can learn and automate a different behavior once we are aware that we've learned something that isn't serving us. Mm-hmm. And that is a huge component of the way that a lot of different psychotherapy practices work, but it's just not taught that well from the neuroscience perspective. But the neuroscience is like, you know, it's undeniable at this point. And what's even more interesting about his discovery, that was one of my most favorites, and this changed learning about this and reading his autobiography, which I highly recommend. It's called In Search of Memory. You don't even need to have gone to college to read this. It's an incredible book about his whole life and how he, leading up to the discovery that won the Nobel Prize. And what's so fascinating is the way that we learn about anything, safety, fear, everything else in between, is the same way that ancient primordial sea snails learn. Same way, same biological mechanism that's happening for them with fear and safety as it does for us. And they're 300 million years older than us. So it's like, once you understand there's certain hardwired pathways in our bodies that are literally so hardwired they can't change, it gives you a completely new perspective on how we cope with stress, how we respond to stress over time, what chronic stress does to our bodies, and how we learn, which it completely shuts down learning, and why safety is so important to promote learning, neuroplasticity, emotional and physical and mental well-being, right? So it changes everything.
You can see the challenges then with trying to fight that, you know?
Can't fight it.
Exactly.
There's no fight.
The difference between embracing versus fighting it is huge.
That's another one that neuroscience has proven that we found, right? That was a great discovery that was multiple discoveries from psychology and neuroscience, but that was another one that really stuck with me, is that we grew up thinking we're supposed to be fighting against something all the time. That's not how it works. That's not how we actually invoke change. Change comes from accepting what's going on. And then once you've accepted it, it's not a fight. You're just greasing the wheels trying to figure out, okay, what's the smoothest path through this crag or this cave or this whatever it is, quicksand, right? Like, how do I figure out, using my great intellect and that of everyone around me, how to get to the other side safely? But it's not a fight. There's the battle, and the fight is actually it's the preconceived notion that actually prevents us from achieving the success we're trying to get access to. Because when we fight, we create resistance, and resistance creates opposition, and opposition stops us from growing.
We'll be back with the show shortly. I've got a quick question for you. Are you living up to your potential? It's a question that shapes your family, your business, and your overall happiness every single day. That's why I'm excited to introduce the Win the Day Quiz. Head over to winthedayquiz.com right now, answer a few thought-provoking questions, and you'll instantly discover how well you're performing relative to your true potential. And here's the exciting part for our Win the Day family. As a fan of the show, you'll receive a personalized and absolutely free action plan to help you win the day every day. Now, just imagine how transformational the results will be when you consistently show up as the best version of yourself in every aspect of your life. Don't miss out. Take the Win the Day quiz now by visiting winthedayquiz.com or click the link in the show notes. All right, let's get back to the show.
And when you think about fighting, it's almost this nonstop effort, which of course, you know, chronic stress and everything else, which I know we'll talk about in a minute. A question I wanted to ask you was, you know, you've done so much work and research and understanding the science of all this. Is there anything that you believe to be true that you haven't, or that hasn't been proven as yet?
Anything that I believe to be true now that hasn't yet been proven?
Exactly. That you just have an inkling that is true but hasn't yet been...
And you want to get at the good stuff, huh?
Oh, hey, yeah, let's do it.
So I do talk about this a lot because it's one of my most favorite interesting areas, which is... and we don't have to dive too deeply into it, but it is based on the Eric Kendall's work and also Rachel Yehuda's work, also studied Holocaust survivors and showed that both of them showed in different ways that when we experience trauma, like intense, meaningful experiences that we perceive as threatening over time, after which we probably didn't have the support we needed, right? It's kind of like the modern definition of trauma. That causes changes to our stress response gene expression that you can measure. And that if I am experiencing trauma and I haven't resolved or processed that trauma fully, that trauma is changing my stress response gene expression and what's called the epigenetic layer, which is the layer of code that's on the DNA that tells the DNA basically, which is the same in every cell of our bodies except sperm and egg. It tells the DNA to turn certain genes up or certain genes down so that skin knows to be skin and brain knows to be brain and, you know, eyes know to be eye, because all those cells, the same core code. So the epigenetics say, turn eye up and eye and turn down skin and brain, right? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So trauma causes changes to that layer on stress response genes. And if I don't do anything about it, I pass that down to my children. And then they pass it down to their children. And of course, there's an environmental component of trauma, like I described earlier, with seeing the fear in my parents made me afraid, right? But there's also another layer that's happening where they have a change to the way their stress response system's functioning at a core level. And that actually gets passed down, which was not known before that was even possible. I think Rachel Yehuda was one of the first people to ever prove that. And it was an actual fight for her to prove to the world that was what was happening, because that was went completely against the theories at the time. I had a theory after reading her work and studying Eric Kendall that if trauma is like one or multiple intense, meaningful, threatening experiences over time, and what could heal trauma? Because we know that certain techniques heal trauma, for example, like MDMA-assisted therapy, which just completed FDA trials, for phase 3 trials, has the best treatment responses for trauma that we've ever seen in the history of psychiatry for any mental illness. 88% response rate in the phase 3 for treatment-resistant, treatment-refractory patients, and people continue to get better after the treatment has stopped. We've never seen anything like that before.
And what would a treatment window look like?
It's 12 weeks, three doses of medicine, and 42 hours of psychotherapy with two therapists.
Always supervised, is that right?
Always supervised. Hmm. And that's 42 hours though. And people go from 17 years average of never getting better, trying everything, to 55% getting better at 2 months out, to 67% getting better. And by better, I mean entering near complete remission, no longer meeting diagnostic criteria, at 1 year out, 55% goes to 67%. No additional treatment.
And if
we've never seen that before, ever, right? And MDMA works by inducing safety states in the body. That's like molecularly what we know about it, how it works. So I thought, seeing that, I'm like, well, if this is how this is working, and eye-to-eye contact and empathy are based on safety, and, you know, our whole patient-doctor relationship is based on you feeling safe with me in the office, which is why you tell me your deepest, darkest secrets, because if you didn't feel safe, why would you tell me any of that stuff? Then maybe there's something going on here with the safety pathway that we really haven't looked at, and maybe safety is required for healing, true healing.
Ties in very nicely, yeah.
So that was a theory that has been kind of around for a while, but never really brought together in a cohesive way. And so I firmly believe, going back to your question, that safety is at the root of healing, and that we can't heal unless we feel safe, because our recovery nervous system won't function if it thinks it's under threat. It shuts down under threat. So I had this idea that, you know, perhaps you can actually reverse trauma all the way down to the epigenetic code and the way it's recorded on our DNA with radical safety states. Why not? Right? If trauma is radical fear, why can't radical safety reset that? And it turns out that it does. And we just published a small pilot trial in February studying the folks with PTSD going through the MDMA assisted therapy protocol. That was the first pilot first study ever, but we had a large enough sample to show statistically significant repair or remodeling at the cortisol receptor in the epigenetic layer that related to how much better people got. So it literally, the radical safety state is impacting the way our stress response system is working all the way down to the DNA.
So if trauma is on a spectrum from 0 to 100, what would be the level of trauma on average that those people would be at?
Of those people?
Yeah.
I mean, they were as traumatized as you could get without committing suicide. Like, these are the people who are the most sick, some of the most sick people that were, if you say 100 is somebody who is the most severe PTSD that is not able to live independently. So they're like so sick, they have to be hospitalized. These people were so sick that they were not able to work jobs regularly. They were not able to have regular social relationships. They were constantly in mental, physical, emotional pain, but they weren't in the hospital. So they were out in the regular world, but really, really struggling. So I would say they're probably like, you know, 80 to 90, somewhere in there, the most severely ill. Mm. So that was a really interesting population to see get so much better, because I mean, Western medicine has basically given up on these people, which is really shame.
It's so weird coming from Australia over here, where you see the advertising direct to consumer. And I know there's various opinions on that, if there's something that perhaps someone's not aware of and all that. But when they read through the list of like symptoms and everything else that can go wrong, like I don't even watch that much TV, but if something's on in the background, you're making a meal and you hear them run through this stuff. I mean,
it's wild.
Then you go to the pharmacy. I feel like you get sick when you walk in the door and you see all of the products that they have for sale. Are any of these just like compared to what, like it's absolutely mind-boggling. I think it's US and New Zealand are the two countries in the world where you can advertise pharmaceuticals direct to consumer.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very strange. Mm. You know, I think most doctors who practice medicine, who don't work directly for big pharmaceutical companies, have never been a fan of that, because why should the patients or individual consumers who don't know anything about these medicines be suggesting their own treatments, right? It doesn't really make sense. But what ultimately has happened is that, unfortunately, doctors have only so much time to spend with you. And if you're going to spend that time talking about a treatment you saw on TV that you really want, and they can prescribe it to you and make you happy and get you out of the office, and you could do a trial, and, you know, even if there's side effects, people will want that as the outcome, even because they don't know, you know, they just don't know. Like, I can't tell you how many people come to me and regularly ask for prescription medicine that is blatantly harmful to them because they've heard from another person or on TV that could solve their problem. And they just don't realize that could actually be something that sets off an addiction or dependency or creates some terrible problem that would be actually much worse than what they're struggling with right now. And so a big part of our job is how do we and we do this a lot with our nonprofit, the Board of Medicine, is how do we educate the community, the medical community, the clinician and treating community, but also the patient community, to understand and be empowered, like we were talking about earlier, to actually take in all this information and know when they can trust their doctor and their clinician, right? And know when they have to ask the hard questions, because we want our patients to ask questions, but most doctors don't want their patients to tell them how to practice medicine, right? As they should, right? We should be able to deliver care effectively. And we can in most cases, but it creates a lot of challenge.
What is the ethical idea around if, as a medical professional, the patient believes what you tell them, good or bad? If you could give someone a false positive label that's actually going to give them a better chance of healing from what they have, versus, I know a lot of medical professionals do things because they have to cut, you know, they're worried about liability and all of those different things as well. Like, is there a world at some stage where a false positive label is applied?
Like a placebo?
Exactly. Yeah.
It used to be done all the time. One of my colleagues who was an anesthesiologist in the 70s and 80s, they used to call it the placebo. And it worked, right? You know, because they're telling somebody it's going to make them better, but it's just sugar water, right? Or saline, salt water. Can't hurt them, but they're in pain. Give it to them. They don't actually have a reason for the pain that's identifiable to give it to them to get better. Because the mind is a powerful thing. You know, I think we often, like, this is one of the things that's also most poorly taught in medicine and into the general public, which is that the placebo effect is actually the effect of belief that something will or will not work for us. And it has nothing to do with medicine. It has to do with belief that something, anything, whether it's going for a run, whether it's taking a bath or a shower, whether it's taking a pill, any of those things, it's belief that it will or will not work. And to give you an idea of how powerful the mind is at changing an outcome, you can give people a mental health medication, but you can give people a physical health medication, and the placebo effect is thought to be like somewhere between 20 and 30% of the effect. The belief in whether it works or not, 20 to 30% of the effect. That jumps up to 30 to 50% for mental health medications. It's even higher when people believe that something won't work, which is called the nocebo effect, right? So if you believe that something won't work, you can shut it down almost every time. I've seen people shut down full doses of ketamine, like full doses of ketamine that would knock anyone out for a psychotherapy session, that would take anybody into a deep meditative state. I've seen anxious people who just are so uncomfortable with letting go of control of the situation. They're like, I don't want it to work. And it doesn't. And they're completely intact, conscious the whole time. It's incredible. I've seen people shut down lots of other medications. I've seen red pills, and this is one of my favorite studies, red pills work better than blue pills. They're the same contents, but people believe that red pills mean therapeutic, more likely to be the thing that they're supposed to be making them better, and they work better, right? So yes, this happens, and I think it's the most important thing is how do we educate people to understand the power of belief and align your actions with your intentions in the healing process.
If, right? With all of the stuff that you've just spoken about there, how do you have any idea how much of our brains we're actually using then, or how much we're scratching the surface on what's possible? And what even can people do to get closer between the performance they're doing today versus what they could be doing based on their potential?
So I love this question, and I generally start all of my patient encounters with new clients. I always start out with asking them, if they haven't asked themselves this question yet, I ask them the question, which is it possible that what you know, who you know yourself to be and what you know yourself to be capable of in this life is not the complete story? Just that simple question. It's not all we're asking is it possible, right? Can you accept that it could be possible? And almost everyone can say, yes, it's possible, right? And if you can accept that it's possible that what we've been taught about ourselves, who we are, what we're capable of, is not the full story, then it starts to unlock a couple doors in your brain, in anyone's brain, that's like, well, what is the full story? What am I actually capable of, right? What is this thing they call the unknown about me, And then all of a sudden, the questions start coming, right? And so again, it goes back to what we started talking about originally, which is especially important for human potential, for accessing more of ourselves, which we, you know, probably similar to what Einstein said, maybe we're using like 10% of our brains or something like that. We have a lot more. We are capable of so much more than we do in a regular basis. So much more than we are taught that we're capable of. And it's really about, it starts with that simple question, asking yourself of, you know, is what I was taught the full story? If it's not, if there's any single little tiny part of us that thinks that, hey, maybe it's not the full story, let's figure out what that story is, right? And then that actually leads people down this beautiful journey of what we call self-discovery, which I would argue is the entire meaning of life and existence, is to figure out what the purpose of us as individuals being here in this world is, right? It's kind of ironic in some ways or paradoxical. We're here. We want to figure out why we're here. So
you can't be closed to it.
You can't be closed off to it. Maybe the whole point is not to know why, but the why is the process of discovering the why. Does that make sense?
I love that.
And then that unlocks your potential because it opens you up to all the possibilities of what you can actually do and be.
What about someone who has, maybe not themselves, maybe a spouse, maybe a business partner, maybe a friend who they know is just going through, you know, all the chronic stress and exhibiting all the symptoms of that? How do they, and of course, people need to ultimately, and maybe that's the answer to the question, people need to take ownership of where they're at and have that awareness first. But how do you help someone else gather that awareness or start to take that action?
I mean, it depends on where people start.
Just
right.
Leave a red pill on the bench.
I mean, everybody starts in a different place. I think the core of it is really going back to this idea around safety, right? And when we're afraid, our body physiologically opposes change and learning, because anything that is new to us when we're already afraid, or for example, chronically stressed from too much work or too much news or too much XYZ, everything, emails, etc., that puts the body into a state that is very similar evolutionarily, going back to the Eric Kandel ancient sea snails model of like a predator chasing you in the jungle. Like, our bodies don't know the difference between being chased by a predator and being stuck in traffic in LA, right? They react physiologically the same way. Heart rate goes up, respiratory rate goes up, blood pressure goes up, our thoughts start to get fast, we start to sweat a little bit.
And being stuck in LA traffic actually feels like you're being chased by a tiger.
It really does at times. And so that's, you know, so it's really, really important to train ourselves to remember how that we're not under threat, right? What puts us under actual threat? Chased by a predator, being chased by a predator, lack of food, lack of water, lack of air, lack of shelter, right? Everything else, not actual survival threat. Being excommunicated by our community, yeah, that also could be considered a core survival need. But other than those like five things, everything else is considered to be not actually a real threat, not a real survival threat. And so we don't want our bodies to react that way, where we're taking all our precious resources and sending it to heart, lungs, and skeletal muscle and fear center of the brain when we are supposed to be giving a presentation or hanging out with our children and families or driving in a car, and we make irrational decisions and get into an accident, right? And so there's that core system, and how that functions is so important to understand, because then that helps us to learn that by allowing ourselves to feel safe, the tunnel vision clears, right? So tunnel vision, narrowing of sensation to just what is right in front of me right now, is a core survival, what we call sympathetic fight or flight response. Again, not useful when you're doing regular life stuff or recovery stuff or sleeping or trying to be empathetic or creative. It's really only useful for getting away from a predator or getting to safety. So by doing things that remind ourselves that we're safe, all of a sudden the healing process starts to be able to just get more resources, and vagal tone goes up. And you talk about that, right? And rest and recovery nervous system starts to get more blood and resources. Your heart rate comes down, your blood pressure comes down, your thoughts slow down, and then your reproductive system, digestive system, immune system, all of that starts to get what they need to function. And then we feel healthy naturally. So it's the safety. And that's, again, something that just wasn't well taught, but that safety is the core of how we learn new things. And so if we don't feel safe enough to settle down and be present, because we're so focused on protecting ourselves from the future or from past threats, then we can't learn new things. And the things we try to learn don't stick because our brains are focused on other things, right?
And not to mention, as part of that, like, if you look at where the attention is going now, everyone is buried into a phone, you know, constantly. Video games are a massive industry in themselves. And then if you look at the most visited websites, you know, currently, they're social media platforms that have got these really fast-paced videos that everyone's scrolling through. It's porn sites creating this unrealistic picture of intimacy. Mm-hmm. Like, what should people be doing in terms of embedding into their daily routine so they can start to implement some of this wellness and health and recovery and healing that you talk about?
So I break it down into six things that it's really four that you can do anytime, anywhere you are. And then two that are really equally important, but usually require you to kind of like be in your own space, not always, but they are intentional breathing, intentional listening, like listening to music, listening to anything, just tuning in, listening, intentional touch, soothing touch, intentional movement are the first major four, which you can do at any moment. And the reason why these four are so important, breathing, movement, soothing touch, and listening, is because each of those activities reminds us that we are in control, right? They're things that we have control over at any time, unless we're actually in a real survival threat situation. So it instantly shows you, if you can do those things, if you can stop and take a breath, you can stop and wiggle your arms around or do some stretching, dance, if you can tune your mind away from whatever it is you're doing and listen to something else, or you can touch yourself or give somebody a hug or receive a hug, you're safe instantly. And then you can express gratitude, going back to what we're talking about earlier, for regaining control over your attention, which is the gateway to our consciousness. So you show yourself you're safe by doing a safety control practice, one of those four, and then in any situation, any moment, totally free, right? Most economical healing ever. And then over time, you're retraining your brain to master safety control techniques, which, the more you spend time thinking about, this is another great thing from neuroscience, the source of anxiety. This is one of my favorite things that I learned through my training and through my work with my patients. The source of all anxiety comes from thinking about, spending time thinking about things we don't have control over, right? So what's the antidote to that? Spend time thinking about things you have control over. Movement, touch, listening, breathing. Right. And then the last two that are critically important on more of a long-term basis are rest and sleep and nutrition. What we put into our bodies and how much recovery, real recovery time we get, because sleep is like our single most important recovery time. So by making sure that we prioritize those six things throughout the day, every day, as much as we prioritize practicing this or this or texting or whatever it is that we're doing, watching movies, playing video games, looking at anything on the internet of things, right? If we prioritize those control safety techniques, then we are building resilience. We're building our emotional muscles, literally like going to the gym, but you can do it anywhere you go.
For someone who's dealing with like a severe anxiety disorder, would all of those things work for them when applied consistently, or would there be another level of medication or belief that it has to work? Are they other things? Oh, I know it's probably a bit of, you know, a million things you could include. But.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you're talking about
obviously people, the individual too.
Yeah. It's very individualized, right? But I think the core of these techniques that's so interesting is that I didn't come up with them. They're things that came from thousands of years of Eastern tribal medicine and were echoed by Hippocrates, right? Who you mentioned at the beginning of this show, it was one of my favorite Western doctors, or the founder of Western medicine, who had so much to teach us. And so I think the core concept, and again, reaffirmed by Eric Kandel's Nobel Prize winning work about how we learn, is that it doesn't matter what level of sick or well you are, these techniques are critically important for managing anxiety. And anxiety is also not good or bad. It's a signal that's telling us to pay attention to something in the environment, right? If we judge the anxiety and say, oh, that's bad, I hate that feeling, then we're not actually taking the time to feel it and understand by feeling it what it's trying to signal to us. So if we understand that we can feel it safely and process it, then usually within 30 to 60 seconds, what is causing that comes to us, and the solution therefore also comes to us, which is, okay, I'm thinking about something I can't control. Let's redirect my attention to something I can. Let's take a deep breath. Let's go for a walk. Let's go hug a friend or get a hug from a friend, right? The solution becomes apparent. Let's solve X problem that is preventing me from feeling safe and in control. Of course, some people do benefit from medication, whether it's plant medicines or natural or you know, standard prescription Western medications, depending on where you are at on the spectrum. But the beauty of these techniques is they work for literally every human being, because we have so much more in common than we do different. And diagnoses are not for you. That's another thing that Hippocrates, you know, said, first do no harm, right? A diagnosis is not for the patient. It's for us as doctors and clinicians to communicate patterns of illness with each other so that we can figure out how to treat things better. If we tell a person that they have depression or PTSD or whatever illness, especially with mental illness, and the common public understanding is that that illness is a lifelong illness that will never get better, or that most people never get better from, we are literally dooming people to identifying with that. It starts to become their identity. But that's not the goal. That means that their treatments are going to work less well, right? Because they think they're sick forever. So if I'm taught by my doctor who I respect that I'm sick forever because they thought they should tell me my diagnosis, then of course my treatments aren't going to work as well, right? So then you will have to then spend all this time fixing that, which is what we call illness identity disorder, which is the most common thing that I treat in my practice, other than people who have had really challenging psychedelic trips. And then take that and effectively separate identity from what they're actually experiencing so that they know they're not the same. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've made the stupid decision of believing what a doctor had told me about some health things as well. Like, it's wild, you know, you believe that. And then we had, there's a very good friend of mine, Janine Shepherd, who's come on the show before. She's a, you know, she was hit by a truck, 10 days in a coma, 6 months in the spinal ward. And my favorite quote of hers, and one of my favorite quote of all time, she said, I just don't believe it when someone tells me I can't do something. You know, the whole idea of the most important opinion is how you feel about yourself.
Agreed.
And I think that's such a great way of thinking about it. Your business, Apollo Neuro, is just kicking big goals at the moment. What's the problem that you wanted to solve when you launched that business?
So Apollo came out of the work that we were just talking about, and that Eric Kandel's work really inspired me around stress and how we manage our stress response system and how important safety is. And what I realized in my practice between starting around 2012 and then moving forward was that I was working with a lot of veterans, a lot of folks who are amongst the most highly trained humans on the face of the earth and then trained for stress. Then they come back to America and they can't reintegrate, or they struggle every day to reintegrate back into society. And many of them tragically take their own lives. And the suicide rate in veterans, I think, is like, I don't remember the exact figure, but it's substantially
higher. Documented at 22 a day. It's got to be at least double that, not to mention the number of people who have actually tried.
Right. And it's substantially higher than the general public.
For sure.
Which is incredibly tragic and avoidable. And so working with these people, what I started to understand, I was asking the question, like, how is it possible that these people who are so highly trained to survive and work in these horrifying situations that none of us would ever normally volunteer to participate in can't come back to regular, calm civilian life? Like, what is going on here? This is so bizarre. And so I started to study that and pull on those threads. And most of our treatments at that time were also not working. So we're taught to treat PTSD with Paxil, Zoloft, psychotherapy, and a few other things. And, you know, most people who get, especially veterans who wind up on those treatment protocols, over 50% don't experience symptom remission long-term. They're sick. They are actually sick for life. And that was really discouraging for them and for us because, you know, we want to make people better and they want to get better and it wasn't working. And so we started to explore, well, the safety idea, right? And the idea with MDMA-assisted therapy that we talked about earlier, which was extremely influential to me because it was getting better results healing veterans than anything we'd ever seen. And I met Rick Doblin in 2016 in person, who's the founder of MAPS. And I said, Rick, your studies are incredibly groundbreaking. Like, it's so inspiring to me as a psychiatrist to see what you've done and these results you're getting with these incredibly ill people. Can I work with you to figure out how this is working? Like, what is the medicine doing to get this effect. And he wasn't convinced at first that that was important from a resource perspective. But then we talked a little more and he came around and he got me and a few of my colleagues MDMA therapy trained in 2016. And then we started that trial. I talked to you, the epigenetic trial that published in February. And then we started the Apollo Project. And the Apollo Project was, if safety is the key to healing, if safety is truly what unlocks this door to healing and recovery, even from things like severe PTSD in veterans, is it possible to give people some of that feeling of safety on the go without a drug like MDMA? And so asking that question led down this path of exploring everything that makes us feel safe, holding your furry friend, service animal, hugging a loved one, feeling ocean waves wash over you, smelling your mom's chicken soup, right? Like all of these feelings are so undeniably pleasing and soothing and safe. And they're almost universal experiences for humans, right? Almost universal. And so as we started to look at those, we realized that soothing touch really came to the top because it is the most highly evolved pathway, hundreds of millions of years old, that from the oldest mammals that started nursing their young, before they could communicate with any kind of sounds with their young, they nursed them and touched them and hugged them. And that's how they conveyed safety to their newborns. And we still do that today, right? With our babies. And so I thought, well, touch must be more important than we let on for it to be, because it's existed for all these hundreds of millions of years in a therapeutic way. What if we could deliver soothing touch to somebody in a wearable, right? What if we could leverage modern wearable technology to give people that feeling of being calm, present, and safe in your own body, just like when somebody you love holds your hand or gives you a hug on the go? That might solve a lot of problems for people. So we started to test that in ourselves and healthy subjects and through studying electricity and sound. And we found that sound was actually the most effective. And it's basically, Apollo is what you see me wearing on my chest. You wear it anywhere in your body and it just delivers soothing vibrations to your body that could be through clothing or on your skin that induce the ideal breath rhythm that we enter when we meditate, which comes from biofeedback literature, which is about 5 to 7 breaths per minute. And when you send that signal to the body as music or as soothing touch, the body starts to breathe at that rhythm on its own. And then it starts to activate vagal tone and recovery and sleep, decreases pain, and helps people with severe trauma start to feel safe and recover. And as we started to test that more and more, this came from my research at the University of Pittsburgh and the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and the Department of Psychiatry. And as we started to test that more in double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled crossover studies and then real-world trials, people were having basically life-changing experiences where they were going from not being able to work to working, not being able to sit at the dinner table with their family to having conversation and holding court at the dinner table with their family. And it was stuff like I had never seen before in my entire career, from a physical object that you could just hold to your body wear on your ankle or your wrist or your chest. And not
just for the individual. I mean, what about the families and the friends, right? Carers of
exactly, nine? Exactly.
Incredible.
And it was one of those moments in your career where you've been hoping for it for so long, especially as a researcher. You know, most research projects fail. I mean, and by fail, I mean not necessarily total failure. Maybe they're successful and they demonstrate something cool, but they don't necessarily change the way we live, right? They don't change the way our friends and our communities connect with each other and really change society for the better. And when this happened, we were just like, whoa, this can't actually be real. This has to be placebo, right? And so then we went and did these double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled crossover studies, and we found out that, in fact, it was not placebo. So that's how kind of scientific methodology really helps you to go into it, is you have to disprove your own bias, right? And then we showed that people, not knowing what they were experiencing, not knowing what vibrations they were getting, their bodies were changing and their cognitive and physical performance and recovery were changing with just these soothing vibrations and not placebo vibrations, without the belief involved at all, because they didn't know what they were getting. And that was just really incredible. And so now, full circle, we're Apollo's a consumer product. It launched in 2020. Anybody can buy it because we wanted to make access to this feeling available to everyone we are also taking it through FDA trials for PTSD and ADHD and a couple other indications that are in the works. But that's the gist.
Incredible. Congratulations.
And Thank you.
You know, obviously well-deserved for all the work you've done, but it must be very rewarding to see some of these transformations that are happening.
Very rewarding, and we are very tired.
But still early in the mission, right? Like, yeah. still a lot of important work to do.
Oh, yeah, a lot of work to do.
What about for the development of kids? Obviously, the behaviors that the parents are exhibiting is exceptionally important in how your kids are going to develop. And again, I can see that just in my kids being very, very young. What tips have you got for parents to be able to help develop their kids and equip them to be able to succeed in this world that we're entering?
Well, so I think, you know, knowing that our children are like sponges, basically. So they absorb us as we spend time around them growing up, when they're growing up. So, you know, I think the most important thing is to know that as a parent, right? To whether you can remember that effect for yourself as a child, just to remember that our children are like sponges. Their brains are incredibly good at learning things, and they tend to, by almost default, respect us and look up to us a lot, whether they are willing to admit it or not. And so that is just really, really important to understand, because if you know that they're hyper fast learners by default most of the time, and that they really respect us, even though they don't always let on that they do, which is challenging in and of itself, but something important to know, then we become their most important role models, right? So the best way to teach a child is to role model the behavior under stress or in not stress times, right? To role model that behavior for the child. If our children see us respond to stress in a just self-destructive, hurtful way, and they see that that's something that gives us some subjective benefit or comfort or et cetera, then kids will often take on those behaviors because that's what they see their parents doing, and it works. It works for them, right? And so I think that is one of the best tips. But I think another one that we also don't talk about enough that we touched on a little bit is self-soothing techniques, right? Discomfort is not a bad thing. Discomfort is an inevitable thing. It's going to happen in your life, usually and hopefully often, but not too often that you're uncomfortable all the time, but often enough that you grow and learn from adapting to the discomfort, right? If we weren't challenged, we would never grow. Challenge makes us uncomfortable because it's new, and then we have to figure out how to adapt to it and grow from it. So creating safe space for our children, no matter what age they are, to be able to feel uncomfortable, and then helping kind of guide them to figure out how to feel comfortable in a situation that previously felt uncomfortable, could not be more important for our children's development, because it teaches them to self-soothe rather than every time they get upset, grab a phone and start doing this, right? Which is a distraction technique that is actually very disruptive to learning how to soothe yourself. Because when you grow up and as an older adult, if you could just grab something like a phone and start scrolling on it every time you're feeling upset, then why wouldn't you grab a bottle of booze, right? Or why wouldn't you grab a cigarette, right? Like they're not that different in the immediacy of the effect, but they are the same in the fact that you're still not solving the problem that was causing your discomfort, right? So the best thing to teach kids to do is to breathe, right?
It's so
just
good.
Yeah, just breathe in for 5 seconds. Breathe out for 5 seconds. And that's just that simple. And, or even if you don't want to worry about time, just fill your lungs as big as you can and then empty your lungs as much as you can. And with each breath, try to fill your lungs just a little bit more and just try to empty your lungs a little more with each exhale, right? And even if they do that for 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 2 minutes, and you just gradually increase that as they get older, they will become so much more resilient and high functioning because they're able to tolerate discomfort. And when we tolerate discomfort, our ability to learn and overcome challenges goes through the roof.
I love it. Not to mention, like, even just putting all of that aside, not to mention how much easier that would make your life as a parent.
As a parent, right. Yeah. That's a side effect.
Yeah, for sure. Last question now before the rocket round. On your best day, what's an affirmation that you would write on a flashcard that you could show yourself on your worst day?
Mm. I love affirmations. I don't repeat them as much as I probably should, but
you might pull out a whole scroll.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But no, I have a lot of them that have come to me over the years. I think one of my favorites, we were talking about acceptance earlier. One of my favorites is that Carl Rogers, always a very famous psychologist, said that, I'm going to probably butcher this, but it was something to the effect of, to truly change, we must first accept where we are right now. And that becomes like the jumping off point for real change. Because if you haven't accepted where you are right now, then rather than trying to change, you're just going to spend all your time thinking about why you wish you were somewhere else. Right. Or why you wish things were different. And that's not actually changing anything. So it's a really funny paradox there. So one of the affirmations that has been really powerful for me is really that everything is as it should be right now. And it's this affirmation of acceptance that just kind of reminds me to let my guard down and reminds me to not resist and not fight so much, because everything can often seem like a fight. It could seem like a struggle, but sometimes it's really just as simple as reminding ourselves that everything's as it should be, as hard as it seems, as painful as it seems, as uncomfortable as it seems, everything's as it should be. And I'm going to figure out how to get through this, right? I'm going to figure out how to take what I know is happening and make a change based on what I know, not spend all my precious human resources thinking about how I wish things were different. I'm actually going to change based on what I know them to be. Does that make sense?
It does. So it's also like a call for being proactive in the future as well about the situation that you find yourself in.
Exactly.
Hey, I'm here. I can do something about it now.
Right. Mm. Right. Because all our power really lies in the present. Right. It's an ancient Buddhist teaching as well, is that all of our power lies in the present. If we spend our time thinking about the past or thinking about the future, then we're not present. And if we're not present, we can't actually be intentional with our energy because we're not here now. We're somewhere else.
I love it. Well, let's now move into the Win the Day Rocket Round. 10 questions for some quick answers. You up for this one, Dave?
I guess I don't have a choice. Let's do it.
That's right. We got you strapped in. Number one, what quote inspires you the most?
What quote? There's so many good ones.
I know
ones.
You've shared a bunch already. Would there be one you've already shared or perhaps a new one?
I mean, I think that one by Carl Rogers. I'm going to stick with that one, which is that to really make effective change in our lives, we have to accept everything as it is up until this point.
Number two, morning coffee or evening wine?
So those often go together for people, as studies have shown. If I had to choose, I would probably choose a good cup of morning coffee.
Number three, what's one bit of advice you'd give your 18-year-old self?
Everything's going to be okay.
Number four, what book do you gift the most or that contributed most to the mindset you have today?
It would be definitely Eric Hendel's autobiography, In Search of Memory.
Number five, is there a vulnerability you once hid within that became your superpower?
I think that it was my sensitivity, which was as a kid growing up as a young boy, like many of us, we get bullied for being sensitive and for feeling and expressing feeling. And so I suppressed that a lot as a kid, and it made me feel really vulnerable to be sensitive around other people. But as I became older, I learned that my sensitivity was a complete superpower, and that I could use it to actually tap into my intuition and understand so much more about my environment and what was needed in the moment, like with my emotions, right? Not judging them, but actually just sitting with them and sensing them. And yeah, that definitely was it.
I could feel that the moment you said sensitivity. Yeah, amazing. Number six, what's one thing you've learned about failure?
That it is inevitable and required for growth.
Number seven, if you could sit on a park bench and have a conversation with someone alive or dead, who would it be?
Whew, that's a good one. I'm going to take that is so hard. There's so many good choices. Alive or dead?
And pretend they're all watching you right now to answer.
Oh, wow. That's a tough one. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to say J.R.R. Tolkien.
Love it. Very cool. Number 8, what tool or resource best helps you run your life or your business?
Tool or resource. So it's not really fair, but definitely Apollo.
I was going to say, this is a prime layup for...
Yeah, no, I've been using that every day for the last 4 years and pretty much, and I know without a doubt that I don't think I would have been doing what I'm doing as well as I'm doing it without it. I mean, it's been a completely life-changing technology.
Mm, I love it. Number 9, share one thing on your bucket list.
One thing on my bucket list. I would like to go on safari, or maybe not. It's not safari per se, but I would like to go to Africa, and to go have somebody who really is connected with the jungle and who like lived there for generations of time with their families and was, you know, an indigenous traditional person who understands the way of life down there, actually show me what it's like to live in indigenous tribal culture and with the animals in that environment. I don't say safari because I don't really like that term, because it's more like we're just watching from a truck, right? But to actually
connection
go
to the
like,
land and the animals, and
exactly, everything. And to like really be connected with and living with nature the way that we did way back in the day. And I've never been to Africa, so I've always wanted to experience that.
Hey, I'll go with you. That sounds like fun. And final question, number 10, what's one thing you do to win the day?
One thing I do to win the day is to wake up reminding myself of how grateful I am to have another shot at another day.
I love it. Well, there are a bunch of ways to connect with Dr. Dave, and we'll link to all of these in the show notes. You can follow him on Instagram at Dr. David Rabin. Visit his website, drdave.io, and grab some wearable tech of your own at apolloneuro.com. Again, all that and more will be linked in the show notes. What a pleasure, my friend. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. This was great.
Thanks for joining me on another episode of the Win the Day podcast. We want to hear your thoughts on what we covered today, so drop a comment on the YouTube version of this episode with your favorite takeaway, any questions you have, or what actions you'll be taking as a result of what was shared in this episode. And if you found value in the Win the Day podcast, leave a 5-star rating on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. You'll find a link to both of those in the show notes. It'll only take you a few seconds, and more ratings really helps other people discover the show so they can get the mindset upgrade they need, and we can bring more winners into the Win the Day movement. That's all for this episode. Get out there and win the day. Until next time, onwards and upwards, always.